Hello, everyone, and welcome to Dr. Dan's weekly integration call. I'm Megan, Dr. Dan's sister, and I will be hosting the call today. Today's call will be 75 minutes, and we will cover some of the submitted questions, and Dr. Dan will speak on the theme for this month that covers one of the many aspects of full spectrum medicine. This call is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine or the giving of medical advice. For questions or for more information, please email us at admin@drdaningle.com. Okay, let's get started. Dr. Dan, turning it over now to you to add anything before we dive in.
Awesome, Megan. Thank you so much for getting us going. And I'd say let's just pick up with questions and then we'll weave in different pieces of content and then we'll see how we want to go from there, particularly if anybody wants to be in the power seat.
Excellent. Sounds good. So our first question is, how to overcome the fear of the unknown by ending a 20-year career in a job that I hate while being the sole provider for a wife and three kids?
Repeat that question to me. Let me just make sure I've got it all.
Mm-hmm. How to overcome the fear of the unknown by ending a 20-year career in a job that I hate while being the sole provider for a wife and three kids?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a specific question. Let's globalize it, you know, into just generally the fear of the unknown. That's typically, well, let's slow it all down because it feels like we're just kind of like we're getting to cruise altitude really quickly. Because I want to put it into context with some of the things we've talked about in the past, which is this whole process of transformation is about gaining more and more skill and more faith in being able to embrace what's coming for usually, if we're talking about the process of transformation itself, then this is a process of going through one stage of development into another stage of development. And that can be personal development. It can be, you know, recognizable development. It might be more of a life stage in transitioning from a specific way of being, whether it's way of being with yourself, way of being with others, way of being with your community, going from, for example, childhood to adulthood. It could be a mini stage of that, like going from elementary school to middle school or middle school to high school. In any of these experiences of moving into the unknown, there is going to be the area of discomfort where the ego has to step outside of the known and open up into the unknown. And it's next to impossible to claim and to receive, right? Those are mutually synergistic. In me claiming something, I'm also receiving it, right? If I'm going to claim something of my experience in life, then there's the recognition, and we're talking about transformation here that's more on the soul level than it is on the ego level. So let's just drop kind of like the need to figure it all out straight away. So we're talking a bit more of like an energetic process. Because the ego doesn't know the difference between annihilation and transformation, right? And we're going to keep repeating. I've said that before. We'll say it again because it deserves repeating. So when I'm talking about claiming something, I'm not necessarily talking about claiming it from the ego. Like, oh yeah, I want that thing, so I'm going to go claim it. This is more of a process of recognizing energetically that I'm claiming this new phase in my life. I'm stepping into this new phase, right? I'm receiving what's coming. That's bidirectional, right? So I'm making a willing choice to step into what's already available. And when I recognize that there's that which is already available, and I avail myself to receiving that, then it happens more quickly. So hence part of the recognition is, what is the intention or the prayer, so to speak, in this process? If the intention and the desire is to move into a new phase of living and new phase of work, right? There was the embedded in this question was this 20-year job. Is that job fulfilling? Is that job enlivening? Or is that job stagnant and has already met its goal? It's already served me. Like an old pair of shoes, they've already served me, and yet if I've grown out of them and I keep trying to wedge my already big foot into a small shoe, it's going to become more and more uncomfortable over time. So this is where the process of reclaiming our faith is really helpful and important. Because if we have faith in the process, then we know that the bedrock of our choices is anchored in a supreme awareness that by leaning into this area of discomfort and perhaps shedding this old job or a relationship that's no longer serving or an old thinking pattern, an old style of relating with the world, if I'm moving from a place of disempowerment to empowerment, whatever that shift in that frame is, if we have faith that the process is going to continue to lead us in the direction of our fulfillment, then it's easier to be resilient in the midst of the challenge. I've given this example before. So what led me into the medicine path in the first place was this recognition that my heart was closed off. I'd gone through a big transition. I couldn't feel it. And I made a big prayer. This is even before meeting who would become my primary teacher in ayahuasca. I made this prayer like, wow, my heart is stone cold sober. I was in a close to a five-year relationship, and I couldn't feel anything once it dissolved. I realized I didn't want to live that way. So the big prayer has helped me open my heart. Let's make a parallel intention. I recognize I'm not in my power. I choose to step into my power. I recognize that I'm holding myself and I'm not free in my life in a variety of ways. How I communicate, being able to go for my desires, being able to entertain my fantasies, being able to hold my boundaries. Let's just use those three. One is open heart love, i.e. So we'll just call them from there. My desire for love, my desire for power, my desire for freedom, right? Each of these is a core need. If I identify what that need is and I make a supreme prayer and an intention to actualize that, then it's also important for me to recognize that in the answering of that intention, in the answering of that prayer, I'm going to be invited to be intimate with everything that has taken me away from that which I choose to experience. So for me, the prayer was open heart, love. I want to be able to feel. I didn't know that meant that was going to mean becoming intimate with everything that had shut my heart down in the first place. And that was a truckload of trauma. It was a lot of what I didn't expect. Because I'm going for love and yet all this trauma comes. I mean, was this in the fine print? Where'd this come from? Same thing. If I'm going for power, then that means in order for me to be in the supreme place of my own power, I need to take full responsibility of every aspect of my life. And that might mean include looking at the ways that I was irresponsible to myself or to others. Might be cleaning up a lot of debris from the past in order to come current and to make amends and to do it well. Like to honor that which has been, but not leave like everything, you know, stuck in this closet of a suppressed desire to just ignore those uncomfortable experiences previously. So if I'm going to be in my full power, then that means claiming all aspects of myself in sovereignty, in choice, in truth, and in presence. And that means everything from the past. So that could be a lot of cleanup work. If my prayer and intention is freedom, then that means I'm going to be invited to experience the potential of humiliation or the potential of rejection. For example, what if in my freedom and expression of my truth, I'm rejected for that? Am I willing to have that? Some people don't put themselves out in a freedom of expression because of the potential of the ramifications. And we still do not live in a culture that experiences everybody to be mutually seen and validated and heard. There are hierarchical administrative scenarios where not everybody is even treated the same. So the expression of everybody's freedom, as long as it doesn't infringe on the rights and the freedoms and the safety and the sovereignty of others, right? That just has to be kind of like, you know, an agreed upon field. That still, when people express their own selves freely, that might be met with a lot of prejudice and a lot of backlash. For example, in our culture, there are still places where if people express themselves as gay, queer, lesbian, transgender, it's not received well. Right? So understanding of a lot happening in the background, these are simply examples, and I'm going to bring it back to the question. So the question is like, how do I step into the fear of the unknown if I have all these things that are going to be impacted by me moving into that unknown? That is also a legitimate concern. So if we're going through a process of transformation, we have to ideally onboard everybody in our arena and in our immediate vicinity to appreciate that something is happening. Like, am I going through a process of transformation and I haven't even onboarded my partner, like my romantic partner, my intimate partner, or my business partner, or my family, or my community, or my best friends, or the people I live with or around? Like, I might go through a significant process that shifts my availability for those relationships in the way that those relationships have known me to show up in the past. If my experience has been overgiving and I go through a process of transformation, maybe I reclaim my boundaries and I realize that wasn't a healthy style. Well, cancel clear. Maybe that was healthy to me, for me to get up to this point. Now I'm realizing that actually that hasn't been healthy for a while, but initially all of the patterns, even the unhealthy patterns, and this is a really important thing for all of us to validate the different parts of ourselves. Every one of our unhealthy patterns, whatever it is, at some point served. At some point, it was a strategic choice to get a primary need that I either didn't have or didn't realize I had. Because we are super smart, we're super creative, everybody is. We're blessed with these really creative minds. And it's also the shadow, because these minds do crazy things, like, for example, tell us that we're not lovable, or not worthy of love, or that love isn't safe, or like these beautiful minds can be horrendous judges of criticism. And yes, since we have this creative potential, we're constantly, consciously or not, usually unconsciously and subconsciously, trying to find different strategies to get the primary needs that we think we either don't have now, or that if we had them to a greater degree, that life would be easier, more happy, more fulfilled. We've gone through the primary seven needs. There's a lot of, we could call them like splinter needs or ego inflated needs based on the community or the social archetype of what is identified as success. So the basic primary needs, safety, creativity, empowered service, contribution, love, expression, wisdom, growth, transcendence, bonding, connection, community, all these are primary needs. And we didn't even talk about, those are all mental and emotional needs. Then you have the physical needs, right? Water, clothing, medical care, food, sunlight, shelter. And so if we have these primary needs and we're constantly negotiating how to get those, but then a lot of those patterns solidify in childhood, and then we reclaim our truth as adults and realize, oh, that's not the way I want to live. Maybe this isn't even the job for 20 years I've been doing that I want to do now. It might feel really threatening, especially like my mom was a single mom and she worked multiple jobs, taking care of two kids. And I was a latchkey kid and I was a bit of a hellion. So she was always trying to figure out where I was and if I was going to be meeting her in the ER because I was doing something silly while I was just, you know, being a regular kid. So that's just to say, like, the process, if there's other people involved, like my mom went through this radical transformational process that significantly affected how she cared for me. Yeah, I would be in the swell of that experience. The blast zone, if it's a really tumultuous one. Some people have those. So yeah, this is a way to think about it strategically. So given all of that, then how do we think about it strategically if we're moving into a place of unknown? We have to solidify our faith, find community, find brothers and sisters, other people along the path who are doing it, try and find mentorship and guides, right? Because no one can make that journey for you. And yet it's really helpful if you have a guide and if you go prepared and at least have support along the way. And then when the ego wants to come in and say, it's wrong, it's not working, you should just go back to the way it was a lot easier there. Like the cage was familiar. When that comes in, we have to have a strategy of how to work with that voice. Because that voice is also just trying to keep us safe. The ego is just trying to keep us safe. And yet it usually outlives its confined experience of the ego walls and defenses that kept us safe a long time ago when we start to wake up. Those shoes no longer fit. So we're going to get into fears in the bigger content piece of today's share. And I won't get into all of that yet, but that's just a way to say that each of us is going through a process of reclaiming our ability to be with fear of the unknown, especially when there's so much happening in the collective. It's a chaotic time in the collective. Make no bones about that. And it might also be by design. I'm reading a book right now called The Fourth Turning. It's actually 20 or so years old. A friend of mine turned me onto it. And essentially it's about cyclical time. I referenced it in the last conversation just to say that generationally we go through these stages and there's four cycles. And each of these four cycles is about 20 to 25 years. So each of these meta cycles takes about a century or so. About 80 to 100 years to go through. And if you look back historically, it looks pretty telling of how we have continued to go through these cyclical patterns. So we know that what happens on the other side of crisis, transformation. What happens on the other side of struggle, opportunity. What happens on the other side of the unknown, more of an ability to live outside our previous limitations and being confined to the known safety of our ego's comfort. So the only way out is through, right? If we're here to play this kind of game, if we're here to grow, and growth is always unknown, right? These cyclical themes might be like the architecture of the experience, but it doesn't connote the expression of that experience. That's always individual and unique and in the moment. So I'll put a pause on that question. We'll move on to the other question, and I'm going to circle back around because fear of the unknown is universal. And this is essentially the definition of anxiety. I was listening to an NPR interview maybe 6 months ago by an English PhD. And he essentially just summated the definition of anxiety is the inability to be with the unexpected, or essentially the intolerance of the unknown. Like, oh, wow, that's a very succinct, powerful summary statement, which is true, and we all have it. and some of us are just more geared to it. Like, what's how is fear and excitement different physiologically? It's not. The same neurochemistry gets like juiced up, like ready for action. The shift is in the mind. The difference between fear and excitement is a place of disempowerment and empowerment, a place of challenge and struggle and strife and opportunity and what gets to happen. You know, it's kind of like one you don't lean in too easily, like fear, typically the kind of the reflexes to avoid. The other, excitement, we typically lean in pretty strongly. And all of that is a relationship that we create in our own minds. Cool. So Megan, I'll turn it back over to you, and then we'll keep riffing out, and I'll come back around to this unknown piece.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Dan. Okay, our next question is, I watched my mom cheat on a boyfriend of hers I liked. Most were alcoholics like her and abusive in their own ways. My pattern since has been dating people who are unfaithful and narcissistic. Now I just stay single, but considering dating again. A twin flame who's a long-term friend, and I have been heating things up, but how do I know if I broke this pattern? Feels like maybe you have some insight. I have been single for years and even had my own nofap journey so I could heal my CPTSD. Also been so focused on Finn and my kid and my business.
Mm-hmm. Well, we seem to have covered just about all the major aspects of life. We talked about relationship. We talked about parenthood from my child experience. We talked about the business at the end. It's like there's a lot there. And the one thing I appreciate about that the nature of that question is that when we address these core wounds, these core issues, it affects every aspect of life. It affects our dharma and how we engage with our work in the world. It affects our primary relationships. It affects our relationship with ourselves and our relationship with life. Because through the working through of these core wounds, and I'll use the word traumas here because you mentioned complex or CPTSD, complex PTSD, which means like the ongoing experience of a traumatic process that wasn't as obvious as like getting blown up on the battlefield, which is like we used to think that just veterans and war-related soldiers who got injured in battle had PTSD, or that was initially called shell shock, or it was called concentration camp syndrome. There's a variety of ways that's been described, and now we appreciate through the variety of different work like Bester van der Kolk's and Peter Levine's, and the list is long, about this complex PTSD, which is like as children having either the experience of neglect or verbal abuse or emotional abuse, doesn't have to be physical, on an ongoing level of complexity and challenges that are described as these ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, that do affect the wiring of the psyche and the nervous system. And what happens with PTSD? It means our fear center gets constantly triggered, and it usually stays on. And that that trajectory can continue, like it can stay on for life, so to speak, or it can be so hot and so intense that it fatigues, and then essentially gets exhausted, and there's apathy on the other side. Even fear is better than apathy, because fear is at least a feeling. Anger is better than apathy, because anger is a feeling. Apathy is like, I just don't got anything left. And that's when oftentimes this anhedonic or this like low motivational depression can lead to suicidality. So we see, as we start to unpack it, this is a very common syndrome. It's estimated that 1 in 3, and somewhere between 1 in 4 and 1 in 6 girls and boys, 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 4 to 6 boys will experience significant physical or sexual abuse as a child. That's just the physical, obvious sexual abuse, right? Now we haven't even talked about the emotional and the mental abuse. So if we talk about complex PTSD, or the fact that most people, I think we just like summate it to say it's probably over half in our culture, people have experienced some degree of trauma as a child. And if that's true, I mean, that sounds pretty reasonable, some degree of trauma as a child, then it's a conversation for everybody. Now, psychological resiliency comes in, and maybe there was the set and the setting and the ability for the psyche to consensually kind of like resiliently take care of itself and heal that. Or maybe that was a learned process or through a lot of depth work that eventually gets healed. If trauma is the commonality, the expression of that trauma is the unique variable. It's going to be unique for everybody. Just like the other area that I geek out a lot on and run clinics in is traumatic brain injury. Everybody's got a unique brain. If you give everybody the same injury, you're going to have a completely different outcome for everybody. And the same thing with the psyche. So as we recognize that these complex experiences, particularly if I'm experiencing my mother in this example, in this question, if I'm experiencing my mother to be not available because of her own addiction and because of her own challenge in intimacy and potentially her own sense of integrity, that she's unfaithful in her relational style. Those are all going to be learned patterns. Not that I have to adopt, but that I'm either learning how to navigate and kind of conform to. Because if I'm a little dude, mom's like the world. Or mom and dad, if they're both there, they're like the center of the universe. And if they're not having a good day, then like my whole universe is not having a good day. And if that happens over a long period of time, then it destabilizes my experience of security in life. And it also doesn't give me a good working model for intimacy. So there's a whole lot there to unpack. And if in the nature of this question, if you're doing the work to ask these questions, then you're already doing a lot more than our parents were able to do oftentimes. And that was even more than our grandparents were able to do oftentimes, because we were coming out of world wars and there was a lot of trauma in the field, and we're now just really having more of these conversations about the importance of talking about trauma in the first place. So I get the sense the work's already happening. It's not easy to know when the work is done. I don't think the work is ever done, to be clear, because these core wounds are also our core gateways. These core wounds of the soul are also the core freedoms of the soul, because they are our biggest teachers. And as such, how do we ever know that we've mastered something and then we've kind of like graduated intimacy school? You know, it's a constant evolution. And even those that are the quote unquote masters in intimacy or relational dynamics, like there's a guy named Gottlieb, I think, Seven Principles That Make Marriage Work. And Sonia was just sharing when he was speaking at Wisdom 2.0 a couple of years ago that he said that the health of the relationship is not dictated by the avoidance of struggle or discord. The health of the relationship is actually the recognition and the ability for the relationship to reconstitute and come back into harmony when there's discord. So it's not like, oh, if you're in a great relationship, stuff doesn't ever happen. It's like, oh, if you're in a great relationship, stuff's going to happen. You just bounce back quicker. Like, oh, okay. That's resiliency in a relationship. And what is resiliency? Resiliency is the ability to bob and weave, adjust, adapt in the midst of challenge. And so we're building resiliency in every aspect of our life through this work and through these kind of conversations and just through the natural two-footed experience of being a human at this time in our evolutionary trajectory. Everything in the universe grows, everything evolves, and we are now in a very dynamic, potentially the most dynamic time in human history, because there's never been this many people on the planet, at least that in written record that we're aware of, and never have we had the opportunity to share as much information as quickly as we can with the speed of our technology that's also exponentially growing. So yes, every generation has its core challenge and opportunity. Ours just seems to be in this very dynamic time where we can have these kind of conversations around the growth potential that we recognize that is inherent in all of us. I've said it also in the past that all the avatars say the same thing. Buddha, Muhammad, Jesus, Mother Mary, Gandhi. Doesn't matter the tradition, doesn't matter the age, doesn't matter the time, doesn't matter the sex. Like, all the big teachers say the same thing. All of the potential, whoever you're idolizing, or whoever's your hero or heroine, whatever's in that person is in you too. It's in all of us. It's just this potential that's consistently being invited to wake up. And this is how and why fear is our friend. Because fear is the opportunity. So I'll put a pause there because I'm about to dive into content. I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole. I want to get on to all the questions before we go any further.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, our next question is, I have been looking back at my childhood and find it ironic that being grounded as a child and what we do to ground ourselves as adults essentially both involve the same practices. Unplugging from devices, staying away from distractions, and connecting with ourselves in quiet time. Can grounding be seen as self-discipline, as self-discipline's meaning has seemed to evolve as we have gotten older? I was never grounded as a child, and trying to heal my inner child, that parental discipline is a type of love that I seem to give myself through a pattern of chaos that calls for grounding. Can I heal that inner child?
Yeah, there was a lot in there. I think there were several points at which my response was yes, 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 and yes. Yes, grounding as a child can look very similar to grounding as an adult. Isn't it fascinating that in the year of 2020, we have been grounded as a global community? Go to your room. Don't come out unless you have a mask on. Don't interact with people that you don't know or don't have to. Stay in your own little bubble. It's kind of like, oh yeah, it's a big important time for everybody to just to get quiet and go reflect on what you've been doing and what you should be doing. And I don't mean should as in like shitting on yourself. I mean, like, is there something that you know would be helpful and important for your life to give more attention and energy to than you have been? Because it's so easy, particularly in our culture, particularly at this time, to get distracted by all the shiny objects. I mean, if you look, I mean, just think, like, pull up your Wi-Fi and look at how many Wi-Fi channels are bombarding your electromagnetic sphere all the time that we can't even see. And then, oh, by the way, when you do turn on your computer, how quick do pop-up ads come? And I'm like, I just want to look for one thing. And then there's like just this barrage. You're like, you're in this YouTube wormhole that you just got like 11 clicks down the subway train. You're like, how shit did I get in this kind of gut? And then like 2 hours goes by. There's just so much that grabs for our attention. And so it's a healthy practice to get grounded. And, you know, then we can just unpack the kind of conversation about what grounded means. Grounded could mean physically. And I don't mean like grounded as a kid, like go to your room. I mean grounded like bare skin on the bare earth. There's a whole great growing science around barefoot technology and being grounded. And what does that mean? Essentially just means like us being close in proximity to our evolutionary trajectory where we have come from nervous systems and physiologic structures that were based in connection to the ground, connection to the earth. And eating and drinking vitalized foods and vitalized water. And that might be a significant reason that chronic disease and inflammatory patterns have just continued to escalate the more and more and more we get disconnected from our shared mother, Gaia, Pachamama, Mother Earth. All cultures describe our common mother and our common home as the divine feminine, right? You got the sun as the masculine force and the earth as the feminine force, and they meet together and we become that bridge between heaven and earth, between the masculine and feminine archetypes and principles. And that's why we all have that within ourselves. So we could talk about being grounded physically. We can talk about being grounded energetically. Like, how do you settle your body? How do you settle your mind? What are your practices of self-regulation? And this is a vital time right now to have practices of self-regulation? Like in the midst of receiving so much stress, it's helpful to recognize first and foremost, and this is why there are more and more wearable devices that check heart rate variability, because it's one of the best ways to understand, if you're just looking at it biometrically, the valence and the kind of the overarching barometer of your nervous system. If you think of the nervous system as a seesaw, you have the parasympathetic and the sympathetic, right? The sympathetic's high, means the parasympathetic's low. You can't toggle them, but you're never in both at the same time. It's either one or the other. We're binary that way, neurologically. And so if we're driving sympathetic overdrive, which most people are in sympathetic overdrive, if you look at their biometrics, if you look at their psychological profile, if you look at their quality of life, most people would say they're stressed. Stress is the number one cause for chronic disease. The number one cause of stress is time urgency. We get in this common, this is, you know, science has been around for 40 years, way back to Herbert Benson and relaxation response, and then all the way up to Wayne Dyer and a ton of other people that have talked about mind-body medicine. Larry Dawsey is one of my heroes in mind-body medicine. Joan Borisenko. This isn't new science, but we're just now understanding the ways that we can put all of this into a coherent narrative of how to live well today. And one of those ways, why do we keep hearing more and more about yoga? Well, yoga was a breath practice to prepare for meditation. In our culture, yoga is more like CrossFit, and it's more of like, we've really masculinized that practice. And yet, historically, it's a gateway to meditation. So we move our body to quiet our mind. And why is there more and more talk about meditation? It's because meditation is an act of grounding. It's an act of centering. You can call it what you will. Maybe it's better to describe it as centering. I think of it as there are a lot of different ways to meditate. Meditation might be, for times 6 months or longer, my only meditation was like walking in the woods, which is a phenomenal meditation. Just get quiet, walk in the woods, commune, do a forest bath. You know, now there's fancy terms for it. And now it also might mean sitting and looking, like if I was in, for 2 years, I studied Zen Buddhism and sitting and staring at a candle, quieting the mind. There's a variety of different practices. The practices that are going to work best for you are the ones that you're going to use. And so surf the buffet and see what fits. It's helpful to know that it's actually an act of empowerment when we proactively choose to take good care of ourselves. And that might mean if everybody else is just running the race, and it seems like they're on the gerbil wheel and they're just like running their asses off, but they don't seem to be going anywhere. It's the supreme act of discipline, yes, to not run. Because the ego's gonna be like, well, everybody else is running. Shouldn't I be running? It's a good question. Are they going anywhere? Are they living, you know, whoever I want to, and comparisons don't actually work, but, it, you know, kind of in the long run, it can help to see, like, if we have a longitudinal perspective of people that are just like running and running and running, like, I coach a lot of executives, and I know a lot of executive coaches, and a lot of my colleagues, we have these same kind of conversations, like, okay, if you had to put a number on the executive force driving a particular pattern of success in their business, how much of that do you think is compensation for a core wound where they're just trying to validate themselves through the scope and magnitude of their own external success? And the numbers consistently are around 80 to 90%. I've asked the same question to a lot of people, and it's always around that range. And that's not to make executives who have a trauma pattern or a core wound that they're rehabilitating through their success wrong. It's not to make that pattern wrong. We all are looking for that pattern and that validation. The reason that I'm bringing that up is the way to reflect and to take ownership of it is to see, okay, am I running from something or am I running to something? Like many of you guys know, Michael Beck was also one of my current heroes, and he's fond of saying your pain will push you until your vision pulls you. So am I getting pushed by something from the background because it's so uncomfortable and I can't just be with it? Or maybe if I'm being with it, it doesn't feel really good. Like the one time in the clinical data that shows that mindfulness meditation is actually damaging is if somebody has severe PTSD. Because you're asking that person to just be with their pain, be with their trauma. And it can just so easily turn into this like continuing to just wire and deepen those neural networks around the trauma memory. So if somebody's in a, particularly if that trauma has been reactivated, then a better meditation practice is a guided meditation, not just a mindfulness meditation where you're just sitting with it. So this just comes back to the fact that there's a lot of different meditations. There's a lot of different reasons to try different meditations on. And so all of this, coming back to the first question around the unknown fear or the fear of the unknown, both of those are synergistic and they're true in either direction. The unknown fear, because usually we don't understand what we're even fearing. And the fear of the unknown is the stepping out of the like comfort zone, the safety cage, into the unknown where we're going to get more up and close and personal with the core fear. So it kind of feeds on itself. I have an unknown fear and I have the fear of the unknown. It's just like, that's part of the gerbil wheel. And so the invitation is to slow it all down and to find a practice where we can self-regulate. Breathwork is the best single way, better way to describe it. Breathwork is the most efficient way to regulate your nervous system. It's the quickest self-practice. Not necessarily the best practice. It's the best practice to do it quickly. And there's a lot of ways to regulate your nervous system. There's a lot of ways to get grounded. There's a lot of ways to get clear. Another practice, another outward practice, like this is what I used to do when I got grounded a lot because I was a bit of a troublemaker. And what would I do when I went to my room? I'd find all kinds of fun shit to do in my room. It's like, oh, I'm going to get to hang out with all my toys. I'm going to draw, I'm going to color. I had a Hot Wheels set. I had Legos. I had like Lincoln Logs. I'd build shit. I'd make a fort. You know, so what do kids do? What do we do when we go inside? We find creative potential. And that's what kids will do if you just let them do that. We as adults, maybe we've accumulated a lot of stuff and we're going to find all of our pain. And that's not necessarily easy to work with. And yet, that's pain that needs to get healed. And so maybe it's an opportunity for me to better identify what is the pain that needs to get healed right now. What is the pain that's calling to be healed right now? And so this is where the opportunity is to just slow down and ask questions. Get curious. What am I running from? What am I running to as a place to potentially save me from my pain and my work? The only way to know that is to get present. That's what the medicine path offers us oftentimes the opportunity to do, because it lets the ego defenses relax and all of a sudden we just get radically present. And if it's a ketamine session, then it's an hour to 90 minutes. I mean, it has residual effect for sure because there's active metabolites still circulating. And if it's an ayahuasca ceremony, it's 6 to 8 hours. If it's LSD ceremony, it's like 10 to 12 hours. If it's a boga ceremony, it's like 18 to 24 hours. If it's a 10-day dark field meditation, then it's 10 days. If it's a 3-week water fast, then it's 3 weeks. If it's a 4-day vision quest on the mountain, right? So you get the idea. Do whatever makes sense for you to the extent that you can hold that container. Or that container, if you feel trusting in somebody else, that person or that those people can hold that container for you, which is even better. Because ideally, you have a container that somebody else is holding so you can just completely collapse in order to go into that fear. Like Joseph Campbell, in the cave that we fear lies the treasure we seek consistently. And so it's glorious to claim our fear, to like get really curious, start asking the question, become intimate with it, ground in that conversation. Okay, so I'll pause there and then we'll wrap up with this fourth question and then we'll give him some more content.
Beautiful. Thank you, Dr. Dan. Our fourth question is actually for the power seat today. Miss Marika has volunteered, so if you'd like, we can hop on into the power seat. What do you think?
Let me just do 5-minute wrap up on content, 5-10 minutes, because it'll kind of weave. I'll riff on that and then we'll go into the power seat. And I want to have plenty of time for that. And I'm tracking the time.
Sounds great.
This is like, yeah, great. Oh. So we were talking about the fear of the unknown and the unknown fear. If we start to unpack, if we get grounded, like let's bring all these questions into like the mix, into the soup. If we're getting current with 20 years of a pattern that we recognize has served, these shoes I've been willing to say with that, these shoes I've been wearing for 20 years, man, these shoes have taken me a lot of places. We've got a lot of holes. I've put so many pairs of shoes. I've resold these things. Like, thank you. Thank you for serving me in this way. Thank you. I'm never going to be able to celebrate how much you have offered my life in a way that is representative of how many places you've taken me. Like, perhaps I can do a ceremony and I can bury you and I can offer you back to the land. Let me take all the rubber off and like, you know, recycle that. But like if it's earth-based materials, like honor it. Like let's honor everything, right? Takuwa kamwe nichilo, everything is sacred. It's Lakota or Rumi's poem in the guest house. Greet each at your door laughing and invite them in. Everything is sacred. Everything is important. Everything has served you to get to this point. It may not be what's going to get you to the next point, right? So these shoes, maybe actually time to like bless them on their way and get a new pair of shoes that you can grow into. So this threshold might be crossed like, oh yes, I realize that now I'm leaving an older part of myself, limited beliefs, scarcity, ways that I made myself small, ways that I gave other people my power, ways that I didn't reclaim my boundaries, ways that I was clingy to other people because I didn't want to be alone or I didn't want to have the experience of loneliness, right? So all of these different fears have a way of continuously operating on our behalf so that they are the sign of what is our work to do. Fear is evolutionarily advantageous, right? But structurally, phenomenologically, at the reptilian brain, right? If we were just to simplify the hierarchy of different levels of the brain, there's the reptilian brain, mammalian brain, and human brain. Reptilian brain, brainstem, like all your basic biofunctions. Mammalian brain, limbic system, modulates fear, gets into bonding, and starts to have like these patterns of accelerated experience of intimacy and the craving of more of that. It's also a storehouse of our memories and how our feelings are associated with our memories that now loops into this third part of the brain, this human brain, this prefrontal cortex, where I can actually objectively reason and I have my cognitive functions and I can plan and my skill in communication is up-leveled to the next potentiality, both verbal but also nonverbal. So there's so much that happens in all three of these, particularly when I'm addressing and working with fear. And fear is evolutionarily advantageous. I'm walking down the jungle floor and I don't see the saber, and I see the saber-toothed tiger and I don't run, then I'm lunch meat, genes don't get propagated. Evolutionarily advantageous. Also evolutionarily advantageous for the personal development work that we're here to do for our own evolution. Because fear, just like depression, just like anxiety, just like any of the things that we would want to make wrong or like aren't convenient or comfortable, are actually signs that something is there for our benefit. Most of the times, fear translates into false evidence as appearing real. You use that as an acronym, false evidence appearing real, F-E-A-R. And most of the time it is false evidence. Like whatever the fear kind of like stimulus is, it's just false evidence. It's a perceived threat. But when we really recognize and anchor into the fact that we are consistently being offered the opportunity to be in the anchor and the position of our own authority. And we start to see the hierarchy of fears is oftentimes paired. So like the ego doesn't like change. So oftentimes there will be a fear of change. That is also the fear of the unknown. That's at the ego level. What about the soul level fear? It's the opposite or the complement. The soul fears stagnation and not evolving and not changing. Because at a soul level, we recognize everything in the universe evolves. We must too evolve. And we can claim and reclaim both of those fears. Like, oh yeah, that's a bit of a push-pull. Like, oh yeah, I fear changing, but I also fear not changing. Different aspects of myself, different parts of myself, different intelligences, we could describe them as. And we realize that the ego is the navigation system. And of course, it's going to make sense that it's helping us relate to the world. And it's always doing its best that it can to help us stay safe. Right? And it worked really well. And now we don't make the ego wrong. We just pair it. Like Gary Zukav would describe in Seed of the Soul, authentic power is actually the collapse in the distance between the ego and the soul. Or like East Forest describes in his song Grandmother Sphere, you know, I just got to a point in my life where my ego and I became teammates. Wow, what a cool concept. We can just welcome and bring back all these aspects. So that's a one aspect or one way that fear can get paired in these two complementary styles. Another is the complementary style of these masculine and feminine fears. The feminine archetype fears abandonment. The masculine archetype fears consumption or being consumed or being caged or being like held down, confined. And so we have these different experiences, and that kind of makes sense if you start looking at attachment theory and you understand that we all have these different attachment styles in intimacy. Some are anxiously attached, the fear of abandonment. Some are avoidantly attached, the fear of consumption. And those are generally masculine and feminine archetypes, but that doesn't mean that only men have this one thing and only women have this thing. Oftentimes we have a mix of both. And men can be anxiously attached and women can be avoidantly attached, for sure. So it's helpful to just recognize that in both of those examples, and we can unpack these pairs, and we might want to do that in the next sharing too, and keep this conversation going around fear as an ally. The name of this part of the sharing was Leaning into Fear. The original one was A Friend in Fear, or Hello Fear. It's like just the opportunity to engage that conversation. How can I find my friend fear? And when fear shows up, how can I better and better claim it as a friend and as an ally and as something here that's just helping me evolve? That takes radical faith. It takes a lot of practice to do that. And it's not necessarily that I'm wanting every day to be fearful. I'm just no longer avoiding fear. And if that wants to come in, great. How do I greet each at my door laughing and invite them in? Happiness comes in, great. Fear comes in, great. Jealousy comes in, great. Scarcity comes in, great. Whatever it is, it takes a lot of practice to get to that point, and we eventually do. Ideally, in this lifetime, and not in this lifetime, then likely in some other experience of existence, because consciousness continues outside of a body, and everything in the universe is evolving. So it makes sense that this consciousness and this monkey suit, this consciousness, once it drops the monkey suit, is going to continue evolving. So we're all going to the same place. We just get better and better in doing that. So we can accelerate that now. And those two pairs are just identification points, whether it's ego, soul, or masculine, feminine archetypes, of the way that we're finding balance in between those. And we're reclaiming that as a sovereign practice. And that does include stepping into the unknown. It does include getting quiet, or i.e. grounding. It does include looking at those things that might be a little bit uncomfortable.
thank you all for saying yes to this work and for your willingness to go deeper. As always, it is a pleasure to spend this time with you, and we look forward to seeing you again next week. Be sure to sign up for our newsletter, if you haven't already, on our Full Spectrum Medicine website. We would love to stay in touch. Thank you all so much for joining us, and we wish you a beautiful, happy, and healthy week ahead.